Let's go ahead and get started. Our agenda is here. On the agenda today, we have a real quick touch on recruiting. I don't think much has happened over the last week. Any updates from IMS Global? I kind of put that in the minutes on the agenda, just if someone from IMS Global were to chime in or were to join the call, they would be able to give us an update from IMS Global. And then we were going to continue what we started last week, which is to go through the ecosystem capabilities, credentialing capabilities that we started last week. Any other updates or changes to the agenda? Anything else that we should discuss today? Okay, if not, let's go ahead and get started. Let's see. First up, is recruiting. Does anyone have any updates on recruiting?
I got an official no from Prometric. Sorry.
You got an official no from Prometric.
Official no. They'd let other people take the lead. Which
Okay. Well, that's.
I have no excuse for them.
Good to know. okay. So Prometric. That was Richard.
Can you guys help me remember
sure,
who's
yeah.
who?
Yeah, Rick,
okay.
That was Richard. Prometric is a no on joining W3C.
Okay. And then I don't have any other updates. We're still kind of in a holding pattern, waiting for W3C internal to read those blog posts. I will try and ping them on that. Stuff hopefully this week at some point. Okay, if there are no other updates on recruiting, we can jump to the next topic, which is an update on IMS Global. And honestly, we don't need to cover this if there's nobody from that's at the conference there. Just off the record, John Timmons and Eric and them are talking with folks like Chuck Severance and a number of the other IMS Global folks that have worked on these types of solutions previously. So those discussions are ongoing. People are having hallway discussions and dinners and all that kind of stuff. We'll get a full update from them next week, I'm sure. But that's as much as I know about IMS Global. Okay, so next up, unless anybody has anything else in IMS Global, let's go ahead and continue through the capabilities document. And again, remember that this document is not public yet. I put the link in IRC, but it is not a public link, so please don't circulate it. Last week we started going over the capabilities of the credentialing ecosystem. So we started talking about things like having an extensible data model and making sure that the data model can be expressed in a variety of syntaxes like XML and JSON and whatever else comes down the pipeline over the next 10 years. We talked about there being decentralized vocabularies, meaning that different industry verticals should be able to create credentials without having to coordinate with other industry verticals that have nothing to do with their credentials. Like, for example, medical really doesn't need to interface with the financial community because you know, they have very little in common as far as credentialing is concerned. Let's see. We talked about the web-based PKI, like a public key infrastructure. Longley, do you want to – I don't feel like I did a very good job of outlining the key importance with web-based PKI for credentials. Do you want to try and take a shot at it this week?
Sure, I can go over it just briefly. So a lot of web-based PKI has to do with the notion that you can find the keys that you need just by making calls to the web. And that's a little bit different from these other systems where the key management is kind of done out of band and through some other protocol that's not built into the system itself. So what we want with a web-based PKI capability is when people sign messages, we want to be able to go find those public keys and be able to find them easily. One of the other features that is part of the work that we're interested in is making it so those keys are available via some kind of decentralized network as well. And that allows people to put keys out on, put them out in this decentralized network and not tie them to a domain. And that's kind of an analogy to the ability to move your phone number around. So you can keep your phone number with you and move it around from different provider to different provider, and you can do the same thing with your keys. So if you end up having, if you choose some kind of identity provider, you don't have to tie your key directly to that identity provider, so that if you go and change to some other different identity provider in the future, you don't lose all the keys that you have that have made assertions about various things in this ecosystem. So a web-based PKI combined with this notion of a decentralized network for storing the keys makes it possible so you can fetch the public keys and so that they follow you around instead of being tied to the particular identity providers that you might choose at some point in time.
Right. So just really quickly, the other thing that I think is important with this web-based PKI bit is that in order to put something on the web, typically you need to own a web domain or you need to go through an organization that's got a domain. And that is fairly it's anti most people because most people don't own domains, and if they store their key information on a separate domain, it's not really theirs. That other domain can control what happens to it. So the thing that's really important with this web-based PKI stuff is that anybody can participate in this PKI system. It's not like most of the other, just about every other PKI system in existence today, where you have to have this special position on the internet in order to participate. So what this means is it allows anyone that effectively has a cell phone, or a laptop, any kind of device that can connect to the internet, they're kind of a first-class citizen in this web-based PKI mechanism versus other PKI systems that exist today where you have to go through these sources of truth or these authoritarian figures. So for example, the certificate authorities are kind of this authoritarian figure that tell you whether or not you have a valid certificate. Organizations like Google and Facebook and Yahoo and really any company that's on this call is kind of an authoritarian figure if we hold key information for other people. So this web-based PKI mechanism, especially for credentials, is supposed to be so accessible that anybody in the world can create a set of keys and start signing information without needing to buy any kind of service. So anyway, it's a far more accessible system than other PKI systems. That's what makes it pretty powerful. Let's see. And then, Andrew, I think you are on the queue.
You answered our question for us.
But I have a... Okay, I'm going to back off.
Okay.
Nate's on the queue next, actually.
Nate, yeah. Sorry.
Sure. Yeah. So one of the just sort of general worries I have about wide scale web PKI is that individuals who are brand new to managing keys and secrets may not have very good security around them. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to what the consequence would be if you know, you well, there's two cases. I mean, you either lose access to your own public key, which is sort of bad that because you can no longer access your identity if that was the only key that you attached to it. But more importantly, I think, like, what are the consequences of having your private key compromised? Can an organization that sort of captures your private key, would they be able to go back, sort of issue fake historical credentials on your behalf, you know, as many as they want, you know, like, even if you had, like, said, okay, my key got compromised at this date, would you have the ability to invalidate your key without invalidating all previous credentials, without giving an attacker the ability to, you know, fake a whole bunch of, you know, credentials backdated?
Right, so like, the short answer is yes. here's the long answer. So let's take each one of those scenarios piece by piece. So the web-based PKI system that we're talking about is capable of listing the key owner. So, you know, who's the owner of the key? And then it's also capable of listing a bunch of organizations or people that are capable of doing key management on that DID. So basically, you've got a decentralized ID. That's the identifier that's used. And then each decentralized ID has a set of keys associated with it, as well as a set of organizations or people that are able to update that record, that DID record. So let's say that you trust absolutely nobody, right? You trust no one. In that case, the only entity that has access to update that DID document that lists the public keys is you, right? So the upside is you don't have to trust anyone. The downside is that if you lose your private key, you're hosed, right? Unless you have two keys, you can have, like, you know, a key on your laptop, a key on your mobile phone, and then if you lose one of those keys, you can still use the other one to update that record and add a new key or revoke an existing key. So this has to do with the trust no one case. If your key is compromised, hopefully you've got two devices where you can remove access to the key before the attacker removes access to it. If you lose your key, you can use your other device to generate or assign a new key to that decentralized identifier. Now, so that's in the trust no one case. In the event that you only have one private key with your DID and you're compromised, and that attacker replaces your key information with something else, you are truly screwed. Right, you have just lost your identity, and that's a worst case scenario, and we don't recommend that people set up their decentralized identifiers like that. Right, what we recommend is that you list at least one other party. This could be an identity provider that you trust to also do key management. So, for example, if you lose your key or it's compromised, you can still have the identity provider update the document, right, and put in new keying information. You can even request that you need M of N signatures to update the document. So let's say your key's been compromised. To prevent an attacker from overwriting all the data, you can say, I require there to be at least three different signatures on my decentralized identity document when it comes to key management to update the key information. So let's say you trust your spouse and you trust your identity provider and you trust your cousin, right? Those are the three signatures that would be required to update the key information. So even if an attacker got access to the private keys, they wouldn't be able to take your identity away from you. So that's the case where you trust a small circle of either organizations or people to be a backup if you lose all of your devices or if you lose access to your private key. Let's see. So I think that at least answers the, you know, what happens if my key is compromised. It answers what happens if I lose access to my key. Now, let's say that there's an attacker that's going to actually go in and compromise something. What you can do, if the attacker has not tried to overwrite your key information and you have the proper protections in place, which is you have, you know, M of N signatures on your identity document, in that case, they would not be able to overwrite the key information, and any credential that they issue from themselves is going to be invalid, because what you're going to do is you're going to go in and you're going to say at the point at which the key was compromised. And if you don't know when the key was compromised, you're going to have to pick the most conservative value, like, you know, a year ago. And then at that point, you have you know, all keys or all credentials that you issued using that private key are definitely invalid. The signature is not going to work out, because you're going to put on your private key that it was revoked a year ago, which is why we suggest that any kind of issuer does not use the same keys in the decentralized network to do digital signatures on credentials. There are certain things that issuers can do to protect themselves against keys being compromised. Okay, I'm going to stop here because I'm seeing a lot of stuff in the IRC channel and want to go back and make sure that we at least try and respond to folks that put stuff in there.
One thing I wanted to do while you read that is Nate was mentioning, what if you lose your key? Can someone go and create a bunch of fake credentials for you? Something that's important is the only kind of fake credentials they could create would be self-asserted ones. So if you lose your key, that doesn't mean that the issuers that have given you credentials have lost their keys. So their keys are still protected, and someone who steals your key can't go now make a fake passport for you that's been issued by the U.S. government. It's not something they can do with your key. They can only make assertions about yourself.
Right, true. But, I mean, so Manu mentioned that issuers would have other mechanisms to keep their keys safe that wouldn't be available to, you know, the average person using the web PKI system. Is it just like issuers need to try harder to keep their keys safe, or are there particular technologies?
So this kind of comes down to proper key management, and this is a huge industry in and of itself. So the financial industry has had this problem kind of solved for many years now. I mean, since the late 80s, early 90s. So to give you an example of what the financial industry does, and it has been doing for the last 20 years, they have hardware. Specific hardware that is locked in data centers that is not connected to the internet that does digital signatures, that does signing. So there are ways of setting up networks and access to these systems such that a key compromise requires a set of, you know, a small armed militia to break into a building, steal the equipment, and even if they steal the equipment, they would also have to compromise, you know, two or three people that hold the multi-part keys to unlock the actual key that's used to do the digital signatures. So there are some really, really like military grade ways of protecting, you know, these types of keys. The other thing that you can do is M of N signatures. So I don't want to go into too much detail here, because, you know, there are tons of things that issuers can do to protect their keys, and it's really up to the issuer and what their security requirements are. Yes, cue Mission Impossible music. It is incredibly hard to compromise some of these keys that are used for digitally signing, like financial industry stuff. Okay, so Nate, did that answer your question? Like it is very much they just need to try harder, but there are very well documented ways of what it means to try harder when it comes to key protection. When it comes to, you know, consumer grade key protection, we believe that there's quite a bit of, you know, protections that we've put in the system right now, and it's flexible. So if somebody decides that, you know what, I don't want to have an IDP, that I have to trust. I'm going to trust my family members. That's totally fine and completely compatible with the system. If other people say something to the effect of I don't really have super high stakes credentials that I manage, or I'm okay with it just being my mobile phone and my laptop. Those are both password protected, and I don't think anyone's going to steal them. Then that's fine. People can choose that, and so it doesn't really the way you do key management is orthogonal to the operation of the system. So people with different security needs can use different solutions, and it all just works together.
Cool. Well, thanks for digging into the questions. I will consider to think about this just sort of on my own. The only sort of hanging one would really be like, so if an issuer who didn't do a very good job of, getting a hardware security module and doing bank-grade security on their key, if they do lose it, do they have to just invalidate every credential that they issued in the past?
No, they don't. They can choose the date at which they start invalidating things. So if they're fairly certain that they were broken into yesterday, or they think it happened sometime in the last week, the only credentials that they have to invalidate are the ones that they issued in the last week. And everything before then would be totally fine. And the way they do that is they just revoke the key and they put a revocation date a week ago from today.
Does that mean that the signature mechanism has some kind of trustable timestamp sort of built into it, so that you can tell when a signature was generated?
Yes, absolutely. The date, every single signature has a date associated with it, so you know
and
exactly.
And you can't backdate something.
To be clear, the other thing that is important here is these credentials typically live at a web address. So the same way that you would check replication, you would check that web address. So an attacker would have to have control over the address where that credential lives and a key. And so
right, yeah, totally good case for having a hosted copy of that credential.
Right, right. And that's really the only way you're truly going to be able to get an updated information on anything is to get it from a new source. So, something that's floating around on the web that doesn't have some piece of data that's floating around in some system somewhere that hasn't been marked as revoked yet, there's no way to change that piece of information. You have to go to the primary source, which is the URL where the credential lives, or go through some other system that is able to ping a system to ask for that information. So that is how those sorts of situations are handled. Because you're right, you can just simply backdate a credential. So it's the same kind of thing as revoking a credential. You have to go to the primary source or go to something that can talk to the primary source and get a message that's signed by a key that has not been revoked that indicates that a credential is no good, has been revoked, or something along those lines.
Cool, and I don't want to take up any more time, but Andrew did just note in the chat that you could issue credentials authenticating the timestamp on a credential. And so I think that could be a really good use case for multiple signatures. If the second signature is from an organization that you trust, basically just saying, hey, I acknowledge the existence of this credential on August 17th, 2015, then you know that it couldn't have been issued, after that date.
Yes, and there's always the last resort of reissuing the credential with the new identifier and getting it to the person. So, there's always something you can do if everything else fails.
Cool.
So
yeah.
I think at the core of this is the reason we're sitting here arguing about all of this is that we're talking about having the general public using PKI, which until now has been considered an open problem because people aren't any good at managing their public keys. So even if you have a good solution, we're going to have to put a lot of effort into convincing people that we have a good solution.
Yeah. And so Brendan, that's an excellent point. The key stuff, at least with the credentials stuff, is very hidden. You don't see it when you use it. And really, it's up to the IDPs to do a good job guiding people to manage their keys, but this is that was Brendan that was just speaking. So yes, absolutely. Key management is a difficult thing. people do not understand how to do it, and they will never understand how to do it, so we need to hide this stuff as much as possible, but still keep it fairly secure. Let's see. Matt is on the queue. If you're going to chat, I know this is you're new to this, Brandon, but if people are going to speak, make sure to put yourself on the queue so everybody has a chance to speak. Matt's on the queue.
And this sort of gets to the casual user trying to manage their own PKI and keys. If I'm, if I have three devices with computers and phones and tablets and four different browsers on each, I've got a key cut on each one of them. How much do I have to sort of repeat that whole exercise of saying I need three signatures to change anything, and do I have to get my wife involved every time I want to go change something about my key? That seems a little crazy.
That is very crazy, and we do not require that amount of we don't require that amount of stuff by default. So like I said, the key management happens fairly automatically. We've got a couple of demos in Authorization.io that show how all the key management stuff is done. Or rather, you don't see the keys at all when you use the system, right? The security is there behind the scenes, but you don't have to deal with it if you're a regular user of the system. So multiple devices, everything.
If I chose that posture, if I didn't choose that posture, then that would be sort of replicated 18 or 24 times across all of those instances, right?
Well, you will have a key for every single device that you have. Let's talk about the default, right? So the default is every single device that you have will have a key associated with it, so that if you lose one of those devices, you just revoke the key for the device and that's all you really have to do. You have to say I left my cell phone on the subway. Please revoke the key for that, right? Or you just say I left my cell phone on the subway, and the identity provider will get rid of will invalidate the key on your cell phone based on the day that you lost it. So the default is every single device that you use, it creates a new key. And the first time you use that device, the first time you use it to log in, the first time you use it to send a credential somewhere, your identity provider will say, I have just detected you're using a new device. And the way it knows that is through a back-channel communication. The device says, use this key. And the IDP says, I don't have that key registered for you. Therefore, this must be a new device. Or I'm guessing this is a new device. So I'm going to ask the user, are you on a new device? And if so, do you want to use this device to send and receive credentials from here on out? And more than likely, if the person says yes, then that key is put in the permanent storage or is permanently associated with that decentralized identifier. So by default, people do not see any of the key stuff happening. They're asked questions like, are you using a new device? Do you want to continue to use this device permanently, to send credentials? Are you on a public terminal? Because if you're on a public terminal, then the key that's generated, the private key that's generated, is ephemeral. Okay, so all that's hopefully did that answer your question, Matt?
Yeah, I think it sort of gets to the sort of the duality of this approach, where the use of an identity provider sounds somewhat optional. You could be your own, mm-hmm. In which case you would have to, I guess, do some work to kind of set up this sort of capability.
Yep.
Or you align with an identity provider and the stuff kind of magically happens behind the scenes.
That's exactly right. And the flexibility is there. The core point is that the flexibility is there and the system works in either scenario. And the choice of how secure you want to be is up to the recipient of the credit. It's up to every party in the system. So issuers can choose their level of security. Recipients can choose their level of security. Credential consumers can choose their level of security. And they can be completely different from one another, and the system still functions.
And do identity providers exist today?
We have, no, well, I mean, yes and no. So we're talking about a new protocol for the web. So no identity provider implements the new protocol for the web because there is no standard for that yet. We do have implementations of the technology that we can show people and say this is, you know, how we think it's going to work. But that's what this group is about actually creating that technology. And standardizing it so that there can be multiple different identity providers. And what we expect to happen, you know, if this stuff ends up being standardized, is that the existing identity providers like Google Plus and Facebook and Twitter and, you know, organizations like that, universities, corporations, all of those organizations could become identity providers by either licensing software and running it, or writing their own software to integrate with the system. Did that answer your question, Matt?
Yeah, I think so. So that would be kind of the friction for people printing their own fake identities, essentially, is having a trusted identity provider.
I didn't follow the question you were asking.
Well, if I wanted to just say my name's James Dean, I could make myself be an identity provider and say I am.
You can, but no one's going to trust your signature because you're not authoritative. They would trust the signature from the right.
So you we have to have this network of identity providers for this to work. In general.
Well, you have to have multiple players in this ecosystem. You have to have issuers, and people need to trust the signature of those issuers. So, you know, an issuer that is operating out of Vanuatu that says you're James Dean, probably no one's going to trust. But if the U.S. government has a digital signature, they're an issuer, and they have a digital signature saying that you're James Dean, people will trust that, more than likely, at least in the U.S. Yeah. The same thing for the identity provider. Okay. And the same thing for the identity provider. There are going to be multiple different identity providers. Some are going to be more secure than the others. But that has nothing to do with the security of the credential. It has to do with the security of your identity and all that other kind of stuff. You know, security of your credentials being at that identity provider, security to make sure that that identity provider, you know, has good key management practices around just the identity provider's keys. So hopefully that is that clarifying or is that making the waters more muddy? Okay, good. And there will be, like Andrew's saying, he can't imagine things working out such that there were not you know, open source identity providers. So there are going to be open source identity providers. There are going to be, you know, nonprofits that run identity providers. We want a rich ecosystem where people can choose their identity providers. So we expect a lot of choice there. And the same thing with the credential consumers. A credential consumer, you know, the where security plays into what they're doing is they care very much about not allowing credentials in that are not from trustworthy sources. So that credential consumer is probably going to say, you know what, if someone is making an assertion about what their name is, I am only going to trust government sources for that information. I'm only going to take driver's license. If you're in the U.S., I'm only going to take a driver's license or a social security, digital social security assertion from the U.S. government. So federal or state government, that's all I trust if I'm looking for an assertion about someone's name. And then there might be some websites where they're like, I don't care what the person's name is, and they can claim, you know, it can be a self-issued credential. Like, if you want to call yourself James Dean, that's totally fine. I'm going to, you know, get a self-issued credential from you, and your name on our website is going to be James Dean, right? So there are variable levels of trust here, and it's really up to the site-consuming credential to decide what level of you know, trust they require. Okay, so that's what we have on kind of web PKI. I see Andrew's typing, Andrew or Brendan are typing quite a bit into IRC. Let's see, Andrew, you've typed quite a bit. Do you want to? Do you have any outstanding questions that we haven't covered, or any statements you want to make?
Yes, but it might not fit here. I think
okay.
that there's a whole section on this list that needs to be added.
Okay. All right. So can we get through the capability? Because we're
yeah,
40
yeah.
past the hour. Let's get
yeah.
through the
you
capabilities.
You asked. I'm backing off.
Okay, and then we'll come back around to it. Thanks. Okay, so we web-based PKI. We just talked about web-based PKI. Choice of storage was basically a recipient of a credential should be able to choose where they store that credential. They should be able to choose their identity provider in the same way that they choose their bank or they choose the wallet that they have in their pocket. The next capability up here is application integration. And this one is, out of all the capabilities, this one is the fuzziest one, meaning that we're asserting that the protocol for managing the credentials by a recipient of those credentials, that you should be able to use other software packages to manage your credentials. And so if somebody wants to, and this is separate from the identity provider, so you should be able to give some other system access to your credentials such that it can figure out things that you should do with some of those credentials. Like, for example, you could give a job-seeking site access to all your learning credentials, your workforce credentials, that kind of stuff. And you could, in that system, could then figure out what you should do with those credentials. Like, you know, I see that you have training in welding, metalworking, painting, right? And because of those things, that qualifies you for this job and that job and this other job. And without getting access to all your credentials, I would never have been able to discover that career path for you, right? So being able to tell apps that they can get access to all your credentials for a limited, you know, amount of time and figure out what you can do with them. Maybe some apps will suggest that you should delete certain credentials and get them reissued. So basically, to have a healthy app ecosystem, applications need to be able to get to your credentials in a non-interactive manner, because, you know, we've talked about transmitting credentials in a fairly interactive manner to date, but there should also be a non-interactive path. That's kind of what this app integration thing is about. The downside, of course, with app integration, it needs to be a bit more focused. It's still a bit fuzzy. Even we have a hard time kind of explaining what app integration means. Okay, so next capability up there is privacy-enhanced sharing. And so this capability has to do with the ability to share a credential in a way that does not violate your privacy. It does not allow your identity provider to track you. So you should, to give a concrete example, if you have a set of medical credentials, let's say it's something like blood type and medical history, right? You don't want your identity provider to know that you're sending that to a, let's say, a cancer care clinic or an OB or something else. Because by the IDP knowing who you're sending that credential to, they can guess about life changes that you might not want them to know about. Right. So it's very important that these credentials, like your identity provider manages your credentials, but they should not know how those credentials are being used, because that enables them to figure out things that you may deem as very private. Longley, you're on the queue.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that this also just has to do with single sign-on on the web. So it also has to do with a just common case where if you use a super provider for single sign-on on the web with use Google or Facebook or Twitter, whenever you use those services presently, what will happen is the site that you're logging into will be communicated to those super providers. And so that they have an idea about every site that you decide to log on to on the web. And so they can track all of that information. There's nothing in place right now to make it possible for you to keep that information private. And a credential system, one of the capabilities of a credential system should be enabling you to keep that information private from your identity provider. They're there to manage your credentials and help you manage your identity, but they don't need to know every place that you go to on the web to share that information.
Yep, thank you. The other thing to note about this privacy enhanced sharing is that it does take, in many of these other cases, we don't take a philosophical stance. In the privacy enhanced sharing, we are taking a very strong data rights stance here, or rather privacy rights stance here, partially because one, we believe in it, that this is the right way to do it, and two, we do not believe that we're going to be able to get something through W3C that violates people's privacy. Too many people are kind of hooked into what's being done with Facebook Connect and OpenID Connect and those systems are being used to track people across the web, and there are many, many privacy advocates that are now very active in the standards space because of that stuff, because of these privacy-violating protocols being used. Let's see. Andrew, I think you're on the queue. Yep.
Hey, so here's where what I wanted to talk about fits. The problem with the privacy enhanced sharing is it works. There are ways to make this work very well. But in the situation where someone has gotten a warrant and proper authorities are trying to figure out what happened, how do you audit the privacy enhanced sharing? This is the last column I wanted to add to this, which is we need in this capabilities to say auditing all of this is a thing under this particular set of circumstances.
Well, so it depends on what you mean by audit. If you're saying, is there a way for law enforcement to come in and figure out who you sent a particular credential to by, for example, using a warrant on the identity provider, the answer is no, they can't do that. Meaning that it is impossible. The protocol is set up such that it is impossible to do that. Now, can they instead get a warrant for your laptop and find out who you sent your credential to? Absolutely. Like, that is still very much possible.
They can also get a warrant on the consumer, the entity that you gave the credential to.
The consumer is going to be insufficient. You would need to have the consumer and the issuer in order to do a full mapping of who that was to what you were issued.
That's fine. What we're saying is you can't warrant the IDP, and the IDP is not really that important in this case. You can get a warrant for the issuer, the consumer, and the person's laptop, and those pieces of information would indicate that you sent a credential.
There has to be a path that requires bureaucracy being traversed in order to intentionally compromise this privacy enhanced sharing for it to be viable. If we can't, essentially, right now you're selling to consumers, but you won't be able to get governments and people who need to be able to undo this privacy under certain circumstances behind it unless there is an established and discussed means of doing so.
Yeah, it's a standard means. So the standard means it's issue a warrant.
Yeah.
That's the standard means, right? And this system doesn't change that model, other than the warrant isn't issued to Google anymore. It's issued to the application that people want to find out whether or not you sent a credential to that application.
Right now, you can decide to share your email address directly with an origin, or you can share your email with an origin through an identity provider. Both of those things are possible, and this system is only using the first mechanism. That's the part of privacy enhancing is you don't, if you go through an identity provider, that information is not shared with them, who you're giving it to. So it's not different from what happens on the web every day today.
Sorry, I was muted. Brandon, does that?
Yeah, it addresses it, and that's essentially what I knew already. But what I'm trying to say is, we need to say that explicitly. That needs to be to this proposal.
Got it. Okay. So okay. Yes, that's a very good point. In the web payment stuff, we specifically pull out regulatory, and we talk about regulatory. So maybe we need to put another bullet item in here that talks about regulatory and regulatory or choice of law or law enforcement or something like that. So it is privacy enhancing, but it also is aligned with regulatory bodies around the world, regulatory compliance. Is that right, Brendan? Is that what you're looking for?
That's perfect.
Got it. Okay. All right. All right. So we'll add that to the list. And you're right. It's very important, especially in the financial industry case. They're heavily regulated. And honestly, like, you know, even education is pretty heavily regulated. Depending, certain areas of it are pretty heavily regulated, as well as medical. So this is all good stuff. Okay, so I think that's it for privacy-enhanced sharing, unless folks have any other questions on privacy-enhanced sharing. The last two, the credential portability has to do with you being able to move your credentials from one identity provider to another without the permission of that identity provider. We don't want vendor lock-in when it comes to identity providers. This is very much akin to kind of cell phone portability, cell phone number portability. You should be able to port your cell phone number from point A to point B easily. And an organization should not be able to hold you hostage by holding on to information that's important to you. So that's what credential portability is about. We just say that there needs to be a protocol from migrating from one organization to another, or one identity provider to another, whether it's from, you know, Google to the identity provider running on your wristwatch, if it's from the identity provider running on your wristwatch to your university's identity provider, all moving those credentials should be very quick, very easy, and kind of recipient-driven. Any questions on credential portability? Okay, and the last bit is credential revocation. So clearly there should be a way for issuers to revoke credentials that have been issued that were either issued erroneously, where it was discovered that the recipient of the credential really didn't deserve that credential, they cheated on the test, or they, you know, the score that they got wasn't quite right, and upon looking a second time, the score adjustment meant that they should not have gotten the credential. So revocation just has to do with the ability that, you know, once an issuer puts the credential out there, it's still somewhat under their control in that they can revoke it at any point they want to. I think Andrew or Brendan are asking if they can do anything more sophisticated than a credential. Go ahead. Can you just go ahead and elaborate on the question a bit?
Certificate revocation is a huge open problem right now for something as simple as SSL. So I'm trying to think, when I was working through this section, I was trying to think of ways we could do it. And I can't find any established method that fits with your basic philosophies and approaches that isn't more complicated than just certificates have a time to live and an issuer can refuse to reissue. The good news is, for privacy enhanced sharing, this is trivial because the issuer has to issue an ephemeral certificate, which they can simply refuse to do. But for cached certificates, that's a lot harder, because this literally becomes a caching problem that looks a whole lot like the SSL certificate problem.
Yes, that's right. So it looks like the SSL certificate problem, but we're approaching it in, I think, a very different way. So everything, or all the data that we're talking about is linked data, and every credential that's issued has an ID associated with it, and that ID lives on the web somewhere. So to check to see whether or not a credential has been revoked or not, you do a GET on that ID. You do a GET on the URL, and you can tell immediately whether the credential has been revoked or not by the issuer. Right. The reason that it is such a mess in the X509 certificate case is because X509 certificates kind of came along well before the web was kind of an established mechanism for sharing data. Right. So there are certificate transparency requirements for X509. There are certificate revocation lists that they're supposed to host and run, but in reality, they're not deployed in a way that is standard. In the deployment scenario that we're talking about, it is mandatory we're saying that you need to issue an ID with your credential, and if you don't, your credential is probably not going to validate. There's a validation process to these credentials, and if you don't have a revocation URL for that credential, then most credential consumers are just probably going to mark it as an invalid credential because they don't know if it's good anymore or not. So that's kind of baked in. That's one of the things that makes it different from the CA system that exists today. And that's also something that allows issuers to issue long-lived credentials. Like they'll issue a driver's license for 7 years, and they can be sure that they can still revoke that driver's license at any point, right? So if you think about when you go to get a certificate, a CA certificate these days, very rarely will they give you anything that goes out more than 2 or 3 years, right? And some of them do it because they don't maintain their revocation list very well. Or there are problems with their revocation lists. Whereas what we're saying is every single credential has a revocation URL that you can check for it. And based on that revocation URL, you know immediately whether or not the credential is good or not. Did that answer your question? I see you put yourself back on the queue. Sorry. No, that's fine. Matt, you're up next, and then Brendan after Matt.
You may have sort of touched on this. I think that revocation in reality happens much, much less frequently than updating a credential that gets renewed under kind of its normal life cycle. So how do we have that kind of living event list that, you know, you're granted this in 2005, renewed in 07, renewed in 09, and 10, but it's the same credential that's kind of had a contiguous lifespan from point A to point B?
Right. Sorry, they're mowing the lawn right outside our window. Go ahead, Brendan, and I've got an answer for you, Matt.
So the question I'm leading to here is, now that I understand how much technical load you're putting on the issuers, requiring them to at least host securely a version of every credential they issue, people we want to be issuers are historically very bad at building and maintaining technical infrastructure.
Yeah.
How do we make it so that this is easy for them?
There are multiple ways that could be done. One of them is they license software or depend on organizations that are not their own to keep these long-term, you know, lists of issued credentials, right? So let's take the education industry for example. So, you know, education farms out a lot of this stuff to technology providers. So when it comes to transcripts, when it comes to even badges and things like that today, they farm it out to somebody that's capable of dealing with it. So that's that. So that's kind of, you know, we can't make the way that we make it easy is we make it much easier to generate kind of open source software and software that these technology or these organizations can run. And if they feel that they are not able to run the infrastructure themselves, we have to make it easy for them to pay somebody else to run the infrastructure for them, right? Yeah, Nate got disconnected, unfortunately. Okay, so we are trying to make the system as simple as possible, but no simpler, right? Because there are a set of things that we're trying to achieve here. Like all the capabilities require the system complexity to be at a certain level. That said, you know, we're talking about a URL on the web, and we're talking about effectively, you know, a revoked or not revoked value for that endpoint. So the database is fairly lightweight for, you know, 4 billion credentials. You could fit that easily on a, you know, in maybe less than a gigabyte worth of information. Well, actually, no, that would be, you would probably need like 10 gigs for it, but it would be fairly simple to store 4 billion credentials. So we believe that people can implement this stuff fairly easily, and if they're a technology organization. And if they're not a technology organization, there will be many providers, service providers, that provide, you know, long-term credential curation capabilities. Did that answer your question, Brandon?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, and then Matt, to answer your question, So these credentials are all based on linked data, which means that you could actually link to live data from the credential. So the credential can be short-lived. It can live for like a year or two. But the data that it links to can link back to the issuer, and the issuer can provide more data associated with that credential. That is far more live. So the credential data, the actual credential data that is updated from week to week. Hold on one second. Sorry. The credential that's updated from week to week or month to month, that data can live on the issuer, and the link to that data can live with the credential that was issued to the recipient. So that's one way to do it, Matt. Another way to do it is that the credential itself can have kind of a refresh link. So there's a refresh link that you can use to pull a new credential whenever you need one. So let's say, you know, it's a short-lived credential that's good for 5 months. Every 5 months, the IDP could actually pull a new credential and store it in the system without needing to involve the recipient of the credential. So Matt, did that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
So in that scenario, it puts a little more onus on the issuer than the simple verification URL that you mentioned before, which is quite simplistic.
Right. Yep.
Okay.
So I guess all of this is to say is that the system that's being proposed is incredibly flexible in the way the stuff can be done. And it is going to take a while for best practices to float. There's some best practices that we already know about, like the key management stuff. You know, we've had enough experience with, you know, what the Bitcoin blockchain, you know, folks have had. We've had experience through the 80s and 90s with X509 and certificate authority. So the best practices there are fairly well known. The best practices when it comes to things like live credential information, that's a little less well known, right? So that is going to, you know, the industry is going to have to figure it out, and each industry is probably going to have to figure it out. The answer in the education space is probably not going to be the same answer in the financial industry space. Okay. So we're out of time for today. Are there any high priority questions that anyone has before we end the call today? Okay. Next week, we'll circle back around to the questions that Brendan and Andrew have to try and make sure that we're covering all of their issues and concerns as well. We'll probably also get an update from how IMS Global went, and I will try to contact W3C and make sure that they're making good progress on doing the analysis and setting up a meeting at the face-to-face in TPAC in Sapporo, Japan later this year. Okay. If there's nothing else, everyone have a great week, and we'll chat again next Tuesday. Thanks, bye.
Thanks, guys.
Take care.